that made me.
We're continuing our whip around Australia, speaking to recipients of Australian of the Year awards on The Year That Made Me. And this week, it's up to the Territory, where we're speaking to the 2020 Territorian of the Year, Dr. Geoffrey Thompson. Geoffrey has been recognised for his role in the evacuation of people in the aftermath of Cyclone Tracy, which basically flattened Darwin between Christmas Eve and Boxing Day in 1974. And since then, he's been an amazing achiever, combining his passions for aviation and medicine, flying his own small plane to Indigenous communities in the Territory and running medical clinics. He also has a very strong interest in the connection between activity and health, as we will hear and as no doubt we are all thinking about at the moment. Dr. Geoffrey Thompson, thank you very much for being our guest on The Year That Made Me.
You're very welcome.
Now, of the years that made you, which one would you specify?
I guess the most dramatic change for me in my life would have been 1974, right at the end.
Yes, it just snuck in, didn't it? Yes.
It did, just Christmas Eve, actually, so it just got in. Yes.
What was 1974 like before Cyclone Tracy for you?
Well, we live in a town where we recognise cyclones, and it's cyclone season. I was the Air Force doctor at the time up here in Darwin, and Darwin was a very active Air Force base at that stage. It's not so much now, that most of that's based down at Tyndall in Katherine, 300k south of here. And so my job was essentially to look after the Air Force personnel and the fighter pilot crew who were here at the time. We'd had a cyclone called Selma about 2 weeks before. And like a lot of cyclones, they're threatened. We follow them on the media and then they pass away and head off to Western Australia and become Western Australia's problem. This one was different. I wasn't actually here on the night because my job rotated with the Navy doctor at the time. So I was in Wagga, and I got a call early on the morning of Boxing Day 1974 to say, get myself to Sydney, or to Wagga, in fact, and then to Sydney very quickly, as I was needed in Darwin because Darwin had been flattened. And you might remember in those days there was no mobile phones and very little communication. And the story that Darwin had been absolutely razed to the ground was actually leaked out by an amateur radio operator who managed to crank up a generator because there was no power, and get the message out to the rest of Australia.
So then you flew in to Darwin. Can you paint a picture for us of what you saw out the RAAF plane window as you touched down?
Very easily, in fact.
Still right there by the sounds of things.
It was there, and I've got photographs of it, which I look from time to time, and not that I need reminding. It's usually to show people who weren't born then. But just devastation. It was like pictures that I remember seeing of Hiroshima, where everything was just flattened and there was very little except the occasional water tower that looked like habitable buildings. The airstrip that we landed on was shortened because it was covered in debris. The house that I was moving from into the new one, which I lost, was all flattened and all our possessions were lost.
So flying into such an unimaginable situation, did you know what you had to do and what were your immediate priorities?
Interestingly, the Air Force trained us well because part of being a military officer in Australia is to look after emergency situations and to particularly be involved in medical evacuation. And in fact, the Air Force have aircraft on standby to do that in floods and fires and things like that. So I guess the idea was to try and find somebody in the chaos who was organising things. And I did that by contacting the medical superintendent of the Royal Darwin Hospital, who was here on the night and, in fact, delivered a baby during that night, and talked to him about how we might evacuate the yet unknown number of injured people who were somewhere around town, wandering around in shock mostly and running up to each other in the streets and saying, thank God you're alive.
The hospital was operational, though? It had survived?
Some of it was. Certainly the brick central section of the hospital where there's operating theatre and emergency generators, yes. But a large number of the wards of the old hospital were prefabricated military-style hospital buildings, elevated a little bit off of the ground with large verandas, and a number of those were destroyed. But people were not injured particularly because they were jammed into the building that was still surviving. So I contacted him, and we made a decision that the Air Force would look after people who needed you know, drips and stretcher evacuation, people with fractures. We saw quite a lot of people who'd lost eyes because of flying debris. Remember, it was in excess of 300 kilometres an hour winds as houses fell down around people. And the Red Cross looked after the walking wounded. So what we then had to do was set up a central point. We had to get people out of the town in a hurry. And Major General Alan Stretton, who in fact that year, in fact, became Australian of the Year for his work with the cyclone, he was sent up here to coordinate all of that from a military perspective.
You must have seen some amazing and awful things during that process and heard some incredible stories of disaster and maybe also near misses. Are there ones that really stand out to you to this day?
So one I recall was, in fact, Dr. Greenaway's wife. He said, look, I've got to go down to the hospital. He lived very nearby and went down to deliver this baby. And he said to his wife, now, I may or may not be back. Tomorrow's Christmas Day and your Christmas present is in the dresser in the top drawer. And he said, stay there all wrapped up with blankets around you just in case, because it was pouring with rain as well, just in case. And anyway, she felt lots of shaking as the house was falling to bits and walls were dropping off. And she peeked out in the eye when the quiet phase of the cyclone goes over the house, where you can just hear the roar in the distance. And she looked out, and unbeknownst to her, she'd actually gone from the upstairs bedroom floor through where the wall once was actually sitting in the same chair, wrapped in the same blankets, but actually sitting on the lawn in the front of the house.
Wow. On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Dr. Geoffrey Thompson, the Territory's 2020 Australian of the Year, about his experiences and 1974, the year that made him dealing with the aftermath of Cyclone Tracy. Geoffrey, what was the impact on you personally, physically and mentally, dealing with this situation? And I'm particularly mindful of this now because obviously we're having this discussion at a time when the call on medical staff all around the world is absolutely massive. What do you recall about just the physical experience of having to deal with such intense situations? And does it tell you anything about the way doctors should approach things today?
That's a very interesting question, and I think about that often when people ask me questions like that about what effect. I think in the first instance, you just do what you have to do. I guess part of my training was to work with the various other doctors who were still in town to triage. In other words, you put aside what might be happening to you, and that was a little bit hard because I knew full well that my wife and I had lost everything that we owned as well as everybody else in town. And so you put that aside and you just do what you have to do. So for that first incredibly busy week, I was just being a busy doctor. I was barely got any sleep that week because between us we would work out who had to go next in approximately 20 people at a time that went off in a C-130 with reservist doctors and nurses on board and a medical pallet with lots of facilities. And so we would just load up one plane, send it off, and then the next and then the next. And that was pretty much our role for that week until the number of people who needed emergency evacuation to better medical care. Then one thing that really hit me, and it was one day, and it took a week for this to happen, where somebody sat down in front of me as I was talking to them and he said, oh, by the way, Doc, how did you fare? And I thought that was really interesting because in times of great crises, like snails, I think we pull our heads in and we get a bit selfish and we focus on our own surrounds. And I said, like you, I lost everything I owned. And he said, oh, well, thanks for doing what you're doing. And then we went on with what we're going on with. So I remember that very clearly, thinking how other people fare when you're in the middle of it doesn't always matter so much. It does to people outside of the city and people who are hearing it from the media, and hence the great generosity back then as well. And I had an opportunity to mention this to the Prime Minister during the Australia Day Awards, is that there was an amazing evacuation of over 20,000 people in that week, but there was an amazing rebuilding program, and you wouldn't recognise it if you saw our city now.
After that, such an intense experience, you eventually left the Air Force and decided to do something very different, using your own plane to run medical clinics to remote Indigenous communities. Can you tell us what it was that made you decide to make that change and why specifically you changed to aviation and remote communities in the NT?
Well, I guess aviation had always been a love of mine from a boy where when I was about 9, I wanted to learn to fly, and I in fact learned to fly and became a commercial pilot while I was studying medicine. And I remember saying to my dad as a 9 or 10-year-old, I'd love to be a flying doctor, having no idea what that actually meant.
Yes.
It just sounded like a good combination of the two things I wanted to do.
Did you know it was actually a job description?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, I grew up in a country town in South Australia in Renmark, and my year 3 and year 4 teacher, I remember her son was an Air Force pilot, and she used to talk about him in our class, and I remember that quite clearly. And then he became a Qantas pilot and did something that's quite impossible these days. He actually flew low in a Qantas plane over Renmark one day at lunchtime and wobbled his wings at us on his way from Sydney to Perth. Imagine that now.
Yes.
And part of aviation medicine training in the Air Force is a comprehensive understanding of the specific requirements of looking after people and keeping people well in the aviation environment, because there are quite a lot of medical conditions where flying needs special consideration. The Air Force, of course, is able to deal with this very well because we've got an aeroplane in such as the C-130 Hercules, which you can actually pressurise way more than you can the civil airliners, and that allows people who have pressure sensitive conditions such as lung injuries and fractured ribs and injured eyes to be transported by air where it would be unwise in civil airliners. So, yeah, my love of aviation, the fact that I was a professional pilot and used to fly as a charter pilot one day a week, that all came together nicely for me, because in those days there were very few doctors out in remote Aboriginal communities in Arnhem Land. And so through initially the Anglican Church, who once upon a time were missioners in those places, they invited me to run regular clinics in places like names of Nooka, Noombawa, Ramanginning, and out at Groote Eylandt, which is probably the farthest that I went, and Owen Pelly, or currently called Gumbalunya. I had a 6-seater aeroplane, so if anybody needed to come back in for medical investigations, well, then I could bring them back with me. And I was licensed to do that, so that was okay.
You've become very passionate about advocating for the connection between health and physical activity. What was it that made you passionate about that particular area? How's Australia looking on that front? And I suppose, what are your thoughts on that issue, given that we're now facing a time where lots of people have to be much more isolated, and that means probably, well, certainly physical activity different from what we're used to, whether it's in gyms or walking around the place?
Yes, well, that clearly is a passion of mine, because I didn't come from a medical family, although a very caring one. And I became enchanted by the medicine, but disenchanted with aspects of it, namely in the sense that we, as our medical schools, largely train very well what I would call illness practitioners. In other words, our doctors graduate with great skills in managing illness, and make the assumption, therefore, that to be truly vitally well and healthy is just not being ill, which we all know is not true. When I sort of was waking up to this concept and seeing that there was this chasm between not being ill and actually being vitally, energetically, enthusiastically well, it was at about that time that the newest specialty area in medicine was formed as a formal specialty, and I'm a proud founding member of the Australian College of Sport and Exercise Medicine. So on one hand, we're the doctors that look after the AFL and NRL and netball and tennis and our Olympians. Mm. I look after the Australian Paralympic team. And, of course, the other side of sport and exercise medicine is exercise. And we don't fare well nationally. If you look at a recent survey of 146 countries in the world, then Australia ranks 140th, if you like, on the laziness scale. So I find that particularly embarrassing. But even worse, our adolescents rank 146th out of 150 in a similar survey. Mm. So we're a nation of sports watchers and sports lovers, but not activity participants. And I think one of the mistakes we've made is that we've locked sport and exercise together. And I don't think that's fair either to sport or to exercise. Sport should be much more than just doing it because it's good for you. And exercise should be something that's like cleaning our teeth. It's something that we do as a matter of routine. And it's not a lot. The amount of exercise, I was lecturing in Singapore last year about this, the exercise we need to do for optimizing our health in terms of some cancers, diabetes, blood pressure, things like that, is literally 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, but every week of your life.
Right.
Just a mile, yeah, and that's all. And if you do twice as much, you're fitter, but you're not necessarily healthier.
And we can do mild to moderate movement even if we're stuck at home?
Yes, and it can be cumulative. It doesn't have to be nonstop. It doesn't have to be half an hour at a time. It can be 3 10-minute sessions. And it's something that really, if people knew that, and even more importantly, if my colleagues in medicine knew that and actually taught that in medical school, which they're not, then, of course, it'd go a long way to making a big difference to the even to our national primary health budget.
Absolutely. Well, Geoffrey Thompson, it's been absolutely superb speaking with you today. Congratulations on being the 2020 Northern Territory Australian of the Year, and all the best for what could be a very pressing 2020 for your medical practice as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it though, but it's but that's always a challenge, and we love being busy.
We do always ask our guests to nominate a song that typifies the year that made them. What's your one, Geoff?
Mine is Louis Armstrong's song, It's a Wonderful World, and there's a little bit of a history with it. In my final year of medicine, when a mate of mine who's now a cardiac surgeon and I, who lived near each other and were good friends, in fact, he ended up our best man at our wedding, we would study long into the night as the exam was getting close by. And I would ring up a local radio station in Adelaide where I was living at the time, and I would either I one night or John the other night would request this song. When this song was played, that was our cue to give up our books for a moment and go for a run. And we would run about 5 kilometres, I suppose, from his house and my house. And we would meet in the middle of the night somewhere, and we would say hello, and we would greet each other. And then, of course, we would ask a question that we thought the other one would find impossible to answer. Just a bit of boy challenging sport. And then we'd run home. And then, of course, the other side of this song is that I'm a passionate believer in this wonderful world, and it's just one of those songs that's always stuck with me.
Well, let's have a listen to it now. And then, of course, perhaps afterwards we can all plough into 30 minutes of mild to moderate movement as well. So, Geoff, thanks very much.
That would be great.
Thanks very much for speaking to us on the year that made me.
My great pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.